This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, my name is Dan. Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly, where we do exactly what it says on the tin. Every week, we'll be learning about the smartest stuff in the science-y sphere, I guess. You can download it as a podcast for free through iTunes, over on your phone and tablet on the Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com. And you can listen to it on your radio Saturday afternoons at 2 on Fun Kids. Now, in today's show, we're talking about an element that is one of the most deadly for humans, but some people still use it every day. That's in Dangerous Dan a little bit later on. Also, we'll talk to two brothers who have invented a brand new way that astronauts can travel through space. I can't wait to get them on in just a sec. First, we're heading to school, though. Not regular school, though. Don't panic. Calm yourself down. And not with soggy sandwiches, scratchy uniforms, and teachers who have forgotten completely what a toothbrush is. No, no, no. This is an intergalactic school, and we need to jump through a wormhole to get there. We're joining Principal Pulsar to learn all about spacemen who are getting ready for a big mission, and they're riding something called the Vomit Comet. Yeah, strap yourselves in. This is Deep Space High.
Deep Space High, the universe handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
This term's assignment is to write your very own universe handbook. You'll want to cram it full of all the basic things you need to know about space exploration. Yeah, the nuts and bolts of it all. So, let's crack on. Talking of nuts and bolts, Electra, do you think this term you might just remember to tighten your screws to stop various robot limbs from impeding my progress across the room?
Sorry, sir.
Let's start at the beginning. What's the first thing you need to do when you're planning a journey into space?
Make sure you've inflated your lunar lilo.
I thought the holiday might have calmed you lot down. Fat chance. The first thing you need to do is work out where you're going. Have a good look at what's out there. So, how do we observe space?
We use a telescope.
Telescopes aren't the only way to observe space, you know, Alex.
Telescopes are, however, a great place to start. Much better than just using our eyes. Sorry, I'd forgotten you've only got the one blurb. Very nice it is too. So, telescopes, how do they work?
The standard optical telescope works by reflecting or refracting large quantities of light from the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum to a focal point observable through an eyepiece.
Or basically, it scoops up a load of light and squeezes it down to a small point on your eye, where the image appears a lot bigger than it started.
That's what I said!
You're both right. But optical telescopes only work for the visible universe. Stuff our eyes, or eye, sorry blurp, can see.
Well, that's when you need a radio telescope, or an infrared telescope, or even an X-ray telescope.
Cool. Are they like X-ray specs? Can they see through walls?
Behave, Alex. Stats is right. Those sorts of telescopes can pick up waves our eyes can't see to give us even more information about the universe, including images. And infrared telescopes are particularly handy because they also give us information about the temperature of a planet. Have a look at this projection of an infrared image. You'd be right. This planet has been covered in ice for billions of years. What about this one?
Well, it's red and orange in swirls. Is it a hot planet?
You're right. The red-coloured images show us that the temperatures on this planet are much higher.
Much more my style. Get the sunglasses on, crack open the sun cream.
And then you'd burst into flames on this particular planet. Still a bit hotter than you used to, Alex. A toasty 3,000 degrees. So telescopes can tell us what's out there and how hot or cold they are. But if we're going to visit, we'll need to know how far we have to go. How do we measure distance in space?
Sat-nav?
It'd have to be a blooming big one. No, there are many ways to measure distance in space, but the most common method is called parallax.
Parallax? Isn't that the horrible galactic lurgy that everyone in school got last year?
No, Stats, although it does sound a bit like a nasty disease. Parallax is better shown than explained. If you hold your thumb in front of your face and look at it first with your right and then with your left eye, can you tell me what happens?
Weird. It looks like my thumb moves.
Bingo. It seems to move in relation to the background. How much it moves depends on how far away from your face it is. The distance to a star or planet can be measured by tracking its movement relative to other stars or planets further away. You have to take measurements from two places in our orbit to work it out. And the distance is given in light years.
If it's a distance, why is it measured in years? Shouldn't it be miles? And what's light got to do with it anyway?
The light year is used in astronomy because the universe is huge. The nearest star to your solar system, Alex, is Alpha Centauri, 24 trillion miles. And because the numbers are so big, scientists came up with a simpler unit. A light year is the distance that light travels in space in one year. It's around 6 trillion miles, give or take a bit. So Alpha Centauri is 4 light years away. Much simpler. That's the bell. Next time, we'll be having a think about how we prepare ourselves for deep space exploration.
Deep Space High, the Universe Handbook with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
We will catch up with Principal Pulsar and his class again next week. So it is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now this week, some insanely smart guys, right, they've unveiled a brand new way that astronauts are hoping to travel through space in the future. It's called the Mars Rover, and we've got the Parker brothers on the phone from America to talk about their invention. So the Mars Rover, tell us what's so special about this thing that's hoping to take astronauts across Mars.
Well, just the fact that we're going to be taking people to Mars is amazing in itself.
Talk to me about what the Mars Rover looks like. I know loads of people in the UK might not have seen a picture of it yet. It looks a bit like the Batmobile. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, a lot of people have said the Batmobile, it's black, so I guess that's where everybody's kind of getting that correlation with the Batmobile. It's very sleek. It has a lot of sharp edges and sharp lines, so it makes a lot of sense that people would kind of attribute it to that. But more than anything, it was built to be different than everything else that people have seen going to space. You know, they're always kind of flat white and plain looking, and I just wanted to make sure that this was very different from that.
There's six wheels, and four of them are attached to the front section and two are attached to the back. The vehicle is actually two separate vehicles. There's a driving part in the front and then kind of a trailer connected in the back that is a laboratory. So when these guys are up there on Mars, they can actually do a lot of scientific experiments while they're in the vehicle.
And what else makes it perfect to kind of cope with how hostile Mars is?
Well, a lot of the design that Shannon came up with was to deal with the problems that people will face on Mars. Like, there are a lot of dust storms, so you have to have all those angled lines so that the dust won't settle on the vehicle. It can fall off and not weigh it down. And there are solar panels so that it can charge because it's all electric. The wheels are really, really large, which keeps it from sinking into the sand because there's a lot of sand on Mars. So there were a lot of things that we had to do in coming up with ideas for the vehicle that really weren't just to make it cool looking, but to actually make the science of it work. Because at the end of the day, that's what's really important, is the science and the math behind it, so that when these astronauts get to Mars, they've got something that will actually work.
But it doesn't hurt anything that they're going to look really cool when they get there, too.
And how long have you been working on this concept?
About 6 months.
Oh, and you've got so far already. That's amazing. Now, I don't want to ruin the hopes and dreams of everyone who's listening and thinks we're going to be on Mars tomorrow, but we've not managed to bring anything back from Mars ever. have we? And this Mars rover, isn't it just a concept? It's not actually going to go up to space.
Yes, that's right. It is a concept. I mean, anytime you're going to do something as big and as elaborate as a mission to Mars, you have to test first. You have to come up with ideas and then test them here to make sure they're going to work and make changes and experiment, because you don't want to realize once you get all the way to Mars that, you know, this is not going to work. A concept is the beginning, and then that evolves into the finished product.
So time-wise then, when do you think we'll see something similar to the Mars rover that you showed this week actually getting across the red planet?
I think the timeline for the Mars mission changes a lot, because, you know, they do have to get all of the technology perfected first. And so I'm thinking, from what we're told by the people at NASA and at Kennedy Space Center, that the children that are right now in the fifth grade are going to be the generation that will be traveling to Mars. By the time the fifth graders are, graduated from school and out and being astronauts, that's about the time when we're going to be landing on Mars.
So any fifth graders that are listening, you may be the one to drive this vehicle across Mars.
So if you're 10 or 11, the Mars rover is what you want to take there. Having said, thank you so much for coming on, lads. As a member of the human race and having seen the Mars rover, I absolutely want that to be the thing that aliens associate with humans, because it looks incredible.
Thank you very much. We appreciate
Thank you.
Thanks, lads. Bye-bye. Huge thanks to the Parker brothers there. And you know what? I've got a little feeling they'd be well up for what's next on the show. Dangerous Dan. It's the part of the Fun Kids Science Weekly where we have a look at the most dangerous things in the world until we run out. And then, yeah, I'm sure we'll head into space on our Mars rover to find out about an alien that drinks blood. We're staying a bit closer to home right now, though, and looking at the periodic table. Now, you might have seen these in your classroom at school. It's a big-looking chart. It's got loads of little letters and numbers on in boxes. And they show all of the elements that we know exist in the world. Because elements make up everything. They make up you and me and the food you eat and the phone, tablet or radio that you're listening to this on right now. And there are 118 elements. Now, some of them are harmless, like oxygen and hydrogen, silver and gold. Others, though, are deadly. Take mercury, for example. It's a metal. It's a metal, though, which is liquid most of the time, so it's strange enough to start with. It's thick, it's viscous, it's heavy, it's silver, which is why people call it quicksilver. And it's extremely toxic to humans as well. It can easily be absorbed through your skin. You don't even need a cut. You just have to have some on you and it seeps into your blood and does terrible, nasty things to you. The strangest thing, though, about all of this is mercury used to be used all the time by humans. The same humans it was lethal to. You know thermometers that your mum might use to take your temperature and tell if you're too ill to go to school? The liquid inside them used to be mercury. We even use it in some light bulbs today. It's an explosive. And in some places, mercury is even in makeup. It's an incredibly deadly element. It's toxic to us humans. You know, our species, we're an odd bunch. Now, we'll talk about some of the science stories that have made the news this week in just a sec, including one car that is dreaming of being the fastest in the whole world, you know, if it had a brain and slept as well. First, we're travelling back in time, though, around 180 million years ago, in fact, where plants are flourishing, oceans are forming, and dinosaurs are still stomping.
Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur.
At the Natural History Museum.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the age of the dinosaur. Welcome to the Jurassic period, which was between 145 and 200 million years ago. It was a time when plant life began to flourish once again, as newly formed oceans brought rain to many parts of the world that had previously been nothing more than dry deserts.
Phew, it's really hot here.
Vast, humid forests covered much of the land. But unlike the forests you see today,
the Jurassic forests were full of giant ferns and tall leafy green conifers, similar to monkey puzzle trees and giant redwoods. Under this towering canopy were smaller leafy plants similar to the ferns and horsetails that we see today. Plants weren't yet producing colourful flowers to attract insects. Instead, many produced cones full of seeds and pollen, or tiny capsules containing spores. It therefore wasn't a time to stop and pick a bunch of blooms. Not that you'd want to, with some of the animals around.
Uh-oh, something's coming.
With trees taller than houses, dinosaurs were built to match. Huge sauropods, some reaching more than 12 metres high, and others over 30 metres in length, roam the forests, reaching up high with their long necks to eat the rough leaves at the top of the tallest branches. Many lived and travelled in large herds, which helped ward off predators.
Whoa, look at that one, it's huge!
Ah yes, that's a Camarasaurus. Brachiosaurus and Camarasaurus were two sauropods you'd find in a Jurassic forest. Both were huge quadrupeds, meaning four-legged animals, with small heads but long necks and large bodies. The Camarasaurus had enormous chisel-shaped teeth that could be nearly 15 centimetres long, and they helped him to chew his food, something not all sauropods could do. Don't worry, they wouldn't be interested in chewing you and me. As vegetarians, they'd rather have some tasty leaves.
Quick, he's looking for more leaves. Duck!
Paleontology. Pick.
Fossils help us understand what dinosaurs were like, but scientists didn't really start to examine fossils until only 200 years ago.
Do you know how a fossil is made? After the soft parts of an animal have been eaten or rotted away, the hard parts, like the skeleton, became covered in silt, sand, or earth. Over time, these layers became deeper, and water flowing slowly through the rock brought minerals that started to replace the bone bit by bit. Eventually, these minerals totally replaced the original bony skeleton with an exact replica in rock, and therefore preserved for fossil explorers to discover millions of years later. Prehistoric animals and plant life can also be found in amber, which is formed when a sticky resin from trees sets hard. Scientists have found insects trapped inside amber, perfectly preserved for us to see today.
We've got loads more episodes from our Age of the Dinosaurs series that you can download right now for free over at funkidslive.com. So let's see what sciencey stuff has happened in the news this week. Two brand new moons have been spotted orbiting Jupiter. Astronomer Scott Shepherd was looking for distant objects in the far reaches of our solar system when Jupiter got in the way. Now, let's not blame Jupiter. It can't help it. It's pretty big and it follows an orbit. It can't do anything. But when it moved, they spotted two moons they've never seen before. Now, they've not just been born, they've been hiding the whole time in the dark, which means that as well as being the biggest and oldest planet in the solar system, Jupiter now has 29 moons. Also, researchers found that fierce competition for homes and nesting sites means that some types of birds and bumblebees are dying out. It's because habitats like hedgerows and meadows have been cut down and lost in loads of countries, so there's nowhere for them to live. And finally, a supersonic car will attempt to break the land speed record in 2018 in South Africa, and it's going to have some slower test runs in Cornwall later this year. The current land speed record is 763 miles an hour, but this bloodhound supersonic car is trying to get to 800, then 1,000 miles an hour. Now, there's nowhere near long enough to travel that fast in the UK. They need to go to South Africa to do that. But in October, they're testing the rocket motor here in Cornwall and taking it to a slow 200 miles an hour. That's a slow 200 miles an hour. Let's get one of our favourite people on the Fun Kids Science Weekly now. It's Techno Mum, right? If you don't know her, simple enough, she's a genius. And she answers all of the questions about technology that you really want to know the answers to. Today, it's all about how game controllers and joysticks actually move things about the screen.
Techno Mum's Tech Line, with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology.
got a call. Hello, you're through to Techno Mum's Tech Line. What's your techno question?
When I play on the Xbox, I use a game controller. How does this make the characters on the screen move?
Great question. Now games controllers can have as many as 14 buttons. Some to start the game, some to run or crouch, and some to make characters do special moves. The buttons might do different things, but they have one thing in common. They're all switches. When you press a button, the switch is turned on, and when you lift your finger off, the switch is turned off. Inside the controller are circuits. These are like roads. They carry the on and off electrical messages back to the computer. Now, as games can be fast and furious, this can mean dozens of messages rushing around every second. The messages are labelled so that the computer can tell which message came from which button. The computer then passes the messages to the game software. That's the instructions which run the game. Special codes in the software make images change or create sounds or even vibrate the controllers. When messages come in from the controller, they're checked against the software. And if there's a match, the code will make the right thing happen. Maybe that means your character will jump until you take your finger off the button. Then the message coming in from that button will stop, and the code will stop too.
Techno Mum's Tech Line, with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology. Find out more at funkislive.com.
We'll have more from Techno Mum in next week's edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. And that is it for another edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Fantastic one it was too. I mean, I know I've presented the thing, so I'm not one to talk. But seriously, we had a cracking episode today. Remember, you can download loads more of our science features like Techno Mum and Deep Space High for free over at funkidslive.com and through the free Fun Kids app you can get for your phone and your tablet. And you can listen to Fun Kids on DAB digital radio across the UK on the free Fun Kids app and online at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.